Any questions from last time? Yeah?
So in the old literature, this lambda is what people call the effective action.
Right? Yeah, right.
Well, but that's not what you're saying, what you're saying.
Right. Right. So the modern thing would be called this the 1PI action. I was supposed to say that. Yeah. And in fact, it's not even, people call this the effective action, they call it the quantum action, they call it a variety of things. But then there's also a class of things that were called effective actions, which were kind of really phenomenological actions or phenomenological Lagrangians, where the rule was, it wasn't just, you didn't treat it like an action. And so there's a whole bunch of things that were all called effective actions, and it was really, it can be confusing if you look at the old literature. So since you asked that, so you remember that the virtue, this was derived from the thing that was originally was e to the iw of j, which was a very similar thing, except you didn't have this here, and then j coupled to the whole field. And that had the property, I just said but didn't prove, but you've seen in your other classes, that if you differentiate it many times, then you get the endpoint correlation functions, but you get the connected part of the endpoint correlation functions, and the connected part is coming because of this, the fact we've exponentiated things, W appeared in the exponent. And so that's a statement that if you were to take this path integral and evaluate it by taking the action and doing this expansion around background, the classical background, and you keep the quadratic piece as being a Gaussian integral, and all the non-quadratic pieces being, you expand the exponent out into powers, so you're always doing Gaussian integrals times powers of fields, then those integrals you can do, and that's the perturbative expansion that people normally do. And the statement there is that, the Feynman graphical language is designed for that, because the way you do a path integral, e to the I, integral d phi of some variable, e to the variable operator, variable, basically that becomes the determinant of the variable to minus a half times delta inverse for, if this is at some point I and some point j. So if you have a whole bunch of these things, you're just sticking in delta inverses everywhere, and the Feynman graphical language is just keeping track of the combinatorics of where the delta inverses go. And there's a number in there too that I didn't write. The statement about connectedness is about the connectedness of those graphs in the way that you normally expect it to mean. The connected graphs are ones where they're come in disjoint sets. And I tell you that because the statement for gamma, although it looks very simple, it looks very simple in the sense that we just have the action expanded around phi. The complication is that we're supposed to be thinking of j as a function of phi. And j is it being defined by this equation, and so it's kind of a self-referential way of setting up the integral. So that makes it look like it might be complicated to use, but the lesson I'm sure you got in your other class was that the nice thing about it is that if you're doing things perturbatively, then all that extra term is doing is it's going through and it's getting rid of all the one-particle reducible graphs. So if you have a graph, like this, that you can break into two by cutting one line, that's one particle reducible, 1PR. And so one way to think of J, because J is the derivative of the action, is that J is very much like a graph with essentially one line corresponding to that, one external line. And so the ability to, what this is essentially doing in your Feynman rules, if you expanded gamma as being classical plus quantum corrections, then what you'd be seeing is that the series for J that you get by expanding gamma is the thing that goes through and it subtracts off all the things that looked like they were constructible from something like that, and that effectively goes through and gets rid of all the graphs like that you can cut in half. So that means that in practice, although this looks complicated, from the graphical point of view, the statement of how to calculate gamma is very simple. All you're supposed to do is sum all the graphs, and external lines here are powers of the background field phi. Internal lines are these correlators for quadratic piece in the quantum phi. And the rule is that you just sum over all the one particle irreducible graphs. So this is now one particle irreducible. And I just tell you that not because we're going to be evaluating a lot of these graphs, but because as far as the nomenclature goes, whereas this used to be called the quantum action or the effective action in the old days, now it's called the 1PI action. That's a more precise notion for it. And its properties are different in general from what you would expect of a classical action, for reasons that we're going to see in a second. The effective action that people would normally just call effective action and not qualify it is also called the Wilson action, and so it's the one I'm about to set up. So this is a tool that you've seen. This is something which you can, no one can stop you from doing this, and it's what's nice about these one-particle reducers, the reason people were talking about this before people were talking about effective field theories was if you're interested in tracking divergences, you don't get divergences, extra divergences from one-particle reducible graphs. All the guts of the infrared divergences are in the one-particle irreducible graphs, and so those are the ones that are useful to track if you're trying to, say, decide about renormalizability, say. So there's a history there. Be aware of the different usage of names. But the theme that we're, the kind of the row I'm trying to hoe is about if there's a hierarchy of scales in your problem, the idea was, the statement was that the observables can be Taylor expanded in powers of the ratio of scales, and the simplicity that follows from that corresponds to this property of nature that small scales decouple from large scales. And so, and then the formalism that I'm going to describe now is designed to make that Taylor expansion happen as early as possible in the calculation so that you can make your calculations as simple as possible, as fast as possible. So all I want to do is adapt this to the case where there's more than one field, and some of them are heavy, some of them are light. So let's imagine two sectors to start with. One heavy, which is to say it's at high energies. I'm using a relativistic language, but this, you could do this for non-relativistic physics if you wanted to. And one is light. So the degrees of freedom here are much more energetic than the degrees of freedom there. So in practice, I'll imagine, let's say we'll have two fields. This is a toy example. So we'll have a light field and a heavy field. And so how do you mean light and heavy? You'll see that there's a variety of ways you could do this, but let's just do the stupid way. Let's just say that we take some reference frame, which we like, and we'll take the energy relativistically for the light particles would be the square root of p squared plus some whatever its mass is, and the energy of the heavy particles would be the square root of p squared plus whatever the heavy mass is. And I'm assuming that the heavy mass is much bigger than light mass. That's kind of what I'll mean by heavy versus light. So then let's say that the high energy sector is just E bigger than lambda for some lambda. And lambda, what I'll do is I'll choose it to be much bigger than the mass of the light guy, but much smaller than the mass of the heavy guy. And there's a lot of room in there by assumption because there's a hierarchy. So we'll imagine that MH is much bigger than lambda, much bigger than ML. And if you don't like the fact that this is frame dependent, you could instead, we could do this in Euclidean space, and you could ask for the four momentum p squared plus m squared to be bigger or smaller than lambda squared. There's a whole variety of ways you can do it. You can even do this in dimensional regularization if you want, which is counterintuitive because there you're not really at face value separating scales. I'll come back to that too later on. But this is kind of a good way to get going. So this tells you that although it's kind of, the notation makes it sound like the light sector is the stuff, the modes of the light field, and the heavy sector is the modes of the heavy field, this kind of a definition shows you that's not quite right, because what will happen is that it's certainly true that all momentum modes of the heavy field will be in the high energy sector, because once you know the mass is bigger than lambda, then you know that for all p, the energy is bigger than lambda. So all the states in H will be in what we'll call the high energy part of the theory. But for the low energy part of the theory, even though the mass is smaller than lambda, there will be a momentum for which the energy will become bigger than lambda. So when I say heavy versus light, don't think of it that I'm taking all the modes of the light field to be light and all the modes of the heavy field to be heavy. Think of it as being the very short wavelength modes of everybody are heavy, and all the even the long wavelength modes of the heavy field are also heavy because of the, I'm using the energy to as the discriminator. So what? So the idea is we want to have some sort of a, we want to profit from some sort of a, the hierarchy between the Taylor expansion in powers of ML over MH as early as possible. And so we're imagining, in order to profit from that expansion, we should be interested in the low energy limit. So if we want to, what I'm trying to do is formalize the statement that long distance physics, like atomic physics, doesn't care about short distance physics. So what I should be doing is asking observable questions about the long distance physics only, and not also asking for observable that see the short distance physics. And that would be the situation where I'm expecting that the short distance physics is going to play some small role, but not a very important one. So where do I choose my observables? That's where I'm choosing what my correlation functions are. I should be only looking at correlation functions that are in the low energy sector. So what I'll do is I'll only couple a current. We're going to write something like this down for the generating function of the correlation functions. And I'll only put in currents that couple to the low energy sector. And that'll be the way we'll build in that we're only looking at low energy observables. So the choice that we only look at low energy observables is encoded by computing only slowly varying correlation functions and so we'll do that by and so we'll compute gamma where the argument of gamma, which is the thing whose correlation functions we're calculating, is only in the low energy sector. So all we just do is we take the definition and turn the crank. So let's define, in principle, we could have had, so for the full theory, so let's say before we make the specialization to low energy things, for the full theory, this is not the low energy theory. What we would have done is we would have had a generating functional which had a light, depended on both light and heavy fields, which we could write in the same way as the integral over the quantum part of both with some action, which has some light plus quantum, or background plus quantum. And we would have coupled currents. So we would have had a current coupled to L and another current coupled to H. That would be the analog of calculating this 1PI action for the full theory to calculate all the correlation functions of H and L if we wanted to. But what we don't want to do that because that's asking all possible questions. We want to only look at the low energy part of the theory. So what we'll do is we won't write this thing down. We'll drop that. So we won't have a current coupled to the heavy fields. And so that'll say that we can still use this thing as a function of little l to calculate correlation functions, but we're only going to get correlation functions of the light sector. So we'll set J equals zero if we choose only to look at L correlation functions. So in this argument that you're doing one particle irreducible graphs for gamma, that would have been true for this thing. And what would have made it one particle irreducible would have been the systematic inclusion of these currents to cancel off the one particle irreducible things. So by not doing that here, by setting J equals zero and not setting J is equal to minus d gamma dL, or dH, I guess, that the one particle irreducibleness for H will no longer work, because this term is no longer there to go through and make cross off all the reducible graphs. So what's left, it still will be irreducible for the light lines, but not for the heavy lines. So if you actually wanted to draw the Feynman graphs for this, you'd be calculating, if we cross that off, we no longer will be tracking H, because this whole exercise that took us from W of J to gamma, the argument here that we shifted and coupled only with the fluctuation was all to do with J being given to us as a function of the background field, which we're now throwing away for the heavy fields. So this thing, if you calculate its Feynman rules, it will not be the sum of all one particle irreducible graphs. It will be what you would call the sum of all one light particle irreducible graphs. So all the graphs that you can cut into two by breaking an L line, you throw away. But if you can cut it in two by only breaking an H line, you still have to keep that graph, because we no longer get to throw it away. So gamma of L is the sum of one light particle irreducible graphs. So it's again a 1PI generator of sorts, but not for everybody. So far, it's just definitions. But once you've done this, and you've chosen not to look at H, this is where you can see how you can make the answer simple soon. And that is that the H integral now doesn't depend on the details of the external fields you're talking about. The H integral only appears in the action. So the logic of simplifying your life is you're nuts to not do this H integral first. Since the L integral will be complicated, it'll depend on exactly what configuration you choose to evaluate gamma at. That's something which it'll depend on if you want the endpoint function or the two-point function or whatever. That integral will depend on what observable you choose to look at, because that's kind of buried in the J. The H integrals, you're not looking at observables with them, so you might as well do the integral over H once and for all, and that at the end of the day then decide what correlation function of the light fields you're interested in. So it would be madness not to integrate over H immediately.
So if H is not Gaussian, how do you
integrate? So it's some graphs. So this is a sum of one particle, one light particle irreducible graphs. So you have to do the graphs with the heavy fields. And it might be, there might be a complicated graph, might involve loops, but in principle, you can do this integral any way you know how to do it. So if all you know how to do is perturbation theory, that would be how you do it. But it doesn't have to be just free. If you can put it in a lattice, you can do it in a lattice. It's any way you can evaluate the integral is up to you, but the logic will be the same. All right, so let's call the answer. So the integral we want to do is integral dH, and remember, So let me do the sloppy version of the argument, then I'll come back and polish it a little bit. So that what we want to do is this integral dH. The only thing that depends on H is the action. So we have e to the I L plus L H. So let's call that e to the I SW of L plus H, L plus L. Definition. That would be the definition of the Wilson action. And this is what you would call the effective action. And you know, the point of writing it as e to the I something is that it's very suggestive. If we do that, and then we write this again after we've done the H integral, then we know how to calculate gamma. So if someone told you what S Wilson was, then the answer for the thing you really want to know is just this. Right? Because all I'm just doing is I'm replacing the integral that you did with the answer. And that, now, supposing you walk in the room right now and you didn't hear the first part of my preamble, you'd say, oh yeah, so he's calculating the one particle irreducible graphs and he's doing it with the classical action and it's all good. And so the logic, the utility of this is that the answer you get looks like a classical action. Now, you're going to use it like you use a classical action. The thing that's not obvious yet is that it has the properties that you demand of a classical action. Because normally the thing is, when you do an integral over something, it's some god-awful mess. And when we talk about actions, we normally are talking about local things that are polynomials and fields, or they're simple in some way. And this gives you a way to decide. So the one non-trivial thing that's going to happen is that this thing, which would have been some god-awful mess, becomes simple if you have a hierarchy of scales like this, or the same thing for lambda, that you're using to define the heavy part of your integral. And if you Taylor expand, so if you evaluate your answer as a series in light scales divided by heavy scales, so that might be m light over m heavy or m light over lambda, depending on how you set the problem up. If once you do that Taylor expansion, then it turns out that this action is very simple. It becomes an integral over a local quantity. It's real, and it has all the properties that you normally are demanding a classical action to have. So in general, so the first observation was we use S. Wilson just like we would have used S. classical. And second thing is that if we compute S. Wilson to some fixed order in things like m light over m heavy or m light over lambda, those kinds of things, then S. Wilson is local, real, and all the things you normally ask of a classical action. So that means to say that S. Wilson will be some integral of d4x of some Wilson Lagrangian, where the Wilson Lagrangian will come to you as some function of the field L of x, all at the same value of x, and some ultra-local, and derivatives of L, and so on. In most cases, it depends on exactly the approximation you're making, but usually it comes to some polynomial of fields and derivatives. That would be the simplest situation. There's something I wanted to say here. Oh, yeah. So let me come back to the lambda story. You know, I did this integral over H like I was just integrating over the field H, but I warned you at the very beginning that really this high energy sector also involves L, because there's some modes in L. So this split between L and H that I'm making here really is a lambda dependent split. So there's some sort of when you told me what you think the high energy part of the theory is, you have some definition in mind. That tells me how to divide this measure up into light and heavy. And so the answer that you get for the Wilson action will depend on that. If we're only going to integrate over the stuff that's bigger than lambda, this thing, we should kind of flag the fact that it kind of depends explicitly on lambda. Because there's also a piece in here which is the short wavelength pieces of L. So that means that there won't be, you know, one Wilson action. There'll be a Wilson action for every way you choose to set up the precise definition of what you mean by high and low energy. What's left here will also depend on lambda, because I had a measure that was just something, so I guess I should have not have put it here. So here we have some measure that doesn't depend on lambda, because lambda is, I'm going to take this measure and I'm going to break it into a short wavelength part and a long wavelength part, and that split is lambda dependent, but the thing I started off with didn't care about how I made the split. So this part is the high energy part of the split, and what's left is the low energy part of the split. And now I'm going to say something completely obvious, and that is that, so now if you're doing the integral, you might ask, well, how does the lambda dependence show up in answers? Like when I calculate the correlation functions and I want to see what S matrix elements are or whatever, where does lambda appear? And you know what the answer is. It doesn't appear anywhere because it wasn't in your question. The question that you were calculating was something which was really being framed in a way which didn't care about lambda. Lambda is how you're organizing the calculation. You're choosing to do the high energy part of it first and then the low energy part of it. And if you stop halfway through, then things depend on lambda. But when you finish, there's no lambdas in the answer because there were no lambdas in when what, the way the problem was set up in the first place.
So the lambda dependence comes from the subkits, the high energy integral.
Well, so what I'm doing is right. You could think of this as being product over all modes of, you know, D field mode, and then one way of doing it, the way I'm setting it up there, would be that if I ask for the energy of the mode to be bigger than lambda, I'll call that high energy, and the energy of the mode would be less than lambda, it'd be low energy. So this product, I'm going to write it as product, you know, E bigger than lambda d phi k, product of E less than lambda d phi k. And I'm calling that that, and I'm calling, I'm calling that that. So I'm doing a split in the measure to keep track of them. I'm integrating some high frequency modes and some low frequency modes, and I'm just deciding, I'm just labeling them first, and then doing the integral of the high frequency ones first.
This is a little confusing because the notation seems to suggest the psi is the field psi belongs to both dh and l.
Yeah, that's because so for H that's not true. For H, all the modes are in the heavy part, but for the supposing I use this as my criterion for light versus heavy, so in this case what would happen is that all the heavy modes satisfy this for any value of p because the mass is bigger than lambda. But for the light fields, what's happening is that this criterion is going to be a distinguishing amongst the momenta. So if your p is high enough, then you're high energy mode, but if p is small enough, you're a low energy mode. So that's why this split is not quite so simple as just heavy field, light field, all the modes. Really, if I'm doing an energy split, I'm taking some of the light field, the high frequency components of light field, I'm sticking them in what I'm calling heavy when I do that integral.
So how does that affect this definition?
In all possible ways. So this will be some complicated thing that will explicitly depend on lambda in a whole bunch of ways, which you'll have to be explicit about in a second. But what I'm heading towards now is that you've seen this before. Right, because I'm going to tell you that I'm going to give you an action, and all the parameters in the action will depend on some cutoff lambda, and then I'm going to take the Feynman rules that I get from this action. I'm going to stick it into some graph, and I'm going to regulate the graph by cutting it off as some the same scale lambda, and I'm going to tell you that it was amazing. All the couplings in this thing were just what they had to be to cancel the divergences or the lambda dependence of the integrals you did, and you got a lambda dependent answer. That was the renormalization program, right? So this is why the renormalization program wasn't crazy. It was I set this up as a low versus high energy split, but if you came in and all you knew was the low energy half of it, you would have said that, so God gave me this action, and I calculate with it, and I see that, and I know I can't use it to arbitrary high energy, so all my integrals depend on this upper scale lambda. It's particularly in your face because they diverge, but even if they didn't diverge, it would have been true that they depend on lambda, and then I'm choosing, because I don't want the answer to depend on lambda, in the 60s they would have said, I'm going to choose all the couplings to be just have the lambda dependence I have to have for a conspiracy to make the lambdas cancel. Isn't that amazing that that can even be done? But it sounds really bizarre. And the new way of thinking about it is that this process I'm describing is recursive, right? If we had two sectors, one was heavy, one was light, and we could have had three sectors. One is heavier still than all these ones. And you could imagine that the action that we started off with here, this one, maybe there was a third thing that we'd already integrated out, and this is the Wilson action for it. Then all the story we have here of ultraviolet divergences in this theory, before we do this split, are morally the same as the story we have here for the low energy part of our Wilson action definition. And so it kind of, instead of thinking of the ultraviolet divergences in the renormalization program as being one logical thing, and then there's also this really useful way of splitting high energy and low energy modes within your theory that you're interested in, the natural way to think about it is that God only knows what's going on at all scales. You know, maybe the string theorists know, maybe the quantum gravity people know, but someone, you know, eventually Ed Witten will tell us what the answer is, and then when we take that answer, we're going to sit down and we're going to have to calculate with it, and we're not going to be able to do it because it's hard. So we'll assign all our graduate students, and you know, so you'll do all the energies above this scale, and you'll do the ones between this scale and this scale, and you do the ones between, and so then you'll all be working away. And then so you're finished first, and then someone walks into the room and they say, oh, you're doing this integral over this. What's this? Is W for Witten? And you say, no, it was Witten, but then you did the integral over the high energies and you gave me this answer, and that's kind of what happened when we got rid of all the very high energy string states. But from then on, now you were taking what was left and calculating, and it was amazing and all the lambdas canceled. And the thing is, it's a very recursive process, and you don't need to commit yourself once you look at it that way. to this thing being particularly special or being particularly classical or being, it's really, all you're really asking of it is that it's something that reasonably could have emerged from something at even higher energies. And once I show you that this is true, then you'll see that the things that you normally demand, the locality and the derivative expansion, those kind of things, those are just very generic things. And the whole renormalization program was for free. It's just a statement that the cutoffs are, nature doesn't have a cutoff in it, but we don't understand all of nature at once. So we have to organize our calculations with cutoffs where we separate what we understand from what we don't understand. But what we know is that separation is not in nature, so it's always canceling.
In the definition of the Wilsonian action, what is that inside the bracket before dh?
I put a little dl here to emphasize that there's parts of dl, the light field, that are heavy. I did that when I came back to emphasize that it depends on lambda, because the way I first talked about it, I was kind of deliberately being deceptive, where you could just think it's the heavy field and light field, but really it's an energy split that you're making, and that involves both fields. So this is kind of the main point. So then this kind of really, this will change your life. it's one of those things in physics that it organizes everything you do in physics, because it not only is it a nice way to think about renormalization, it makes it not look like magic, but it's a very efficient way to calculate, because it tells you to think about the scales immediately, and if you're not interested in the high energy scales, expand them as soon as possible. And then once you've found this Wilson action, it expresses all you could possibly ever hope to know about the high energy theory, because it's organizing it all in this Taylor series expansion of the scales of interest to you divided by the heavy ones. And if you only have sufficient accuracy in your measurements that you can distinguish one or two or three powers of light versus heavy scales, then that's going to limit the kinds of terms that you can get here. And then nothing else can you ever learn about the high energy part of the theory. And that's the math telling you what nature already told you, that short distance physics decouples from long distance physics. And there's only, if you really have some very small stuff going on, there's only very specific things that you could hope to ever learn about it. And the other stuff is going to be very hard to know, just because it's just dropping out. If you could do infinitely accurate measurements, you could learn everything. But if you're only doing measurements of some precision, there's only a certain amount of stuff you're ever going to learn about small distance physics. And then, that's why it's hard to test quantum gravity. If it's all a Planck scale, that was wonderful when we were ignorant about the Planck scale, because we could predict other things. But if you think you know what's going on at the Planck scale, you're being thwarted by the fact that it's very difficult to probe things at the Planck scale because of the way quantum field theory works.
So is lambda, can we think of it as the high energy cutoff that we introduced when we're...
See, it plays two roles. So from the point of view of the full theory, when you're defining the Wilson action, it's actually the low energy cutoff, because it's what you integrate down to set up the Wilson action.
Right.
But then, if you come into the room after that and someone hands you the Wilson action, all you know is you've got something which depends on lambda, and now for this part of the calculation, it's the high energy cutoff, because that's the scale where you stopped, where the previous calculation stopped. But the high energy cutoff of your loops in your graphs is appearing in your action, because the action was what you got by doing the higher energy integrals. So you should just kind of sit back and just kind of drink this in, because this is really a powerful point of view. And every, for 30 years, people have been recasting some of the, going to different fields of physics and applying this logic. And the power of the logic I haven't shown you yet, because it's just the fact that it's kind of qualitatively working is nice. But the real power of this is that if you want to work to some fixed order in light versus heavy scales, you can choose in advance how far down this action you have to go, and you can identify what are the terms that you need to include and what ones do you not need to include in order to work to the accuracy that you care about. And so you can tell in advance what will be important and what won't be important in your calculations. And so that's a great labor-saving device. So there's two modes in which this is useful. One is if you have a theory that you understand, say the standard model, and you have a hierarchy of scales in it, say all the quarks are a huge range of scales, the W bosons are up at 100 GeV roughly, and some of the quarks are down at 1 MeV. When you're looking at the decays of mesons that are lighter than a GeV or a few GeV, the whole framework of the standard model is overkill. And so the weak interactions are being expressed by W exchange in the full theory, but if you're never energetic enough that you're seeing a W boson, then you don't need all the machinery of the W bosons to understand what's going on at the low energies, and you can calculate what the effective theory would be. And the great thing is that it's the thing that people found historically. You get the Fermi theory as the low energy limit of the standard model, but plus corrections. I mean, you can systematically calculate all the corrections to the Fermi theory because you really have, in secret, the full theory there. And so you can be as precise as you like with these theories if you know what the full theory is, because if you know what the full theory is, you can predict what these interactions are. And so in that language, this is just telling you efficiently which terms to keep and which ones are just dross as far as your calculations are concerned. But the other way to look at this is when you don't know what's going on. If you have some sort of a theory, or either you don't know what's going on or you can't calculate what's going on. So a lot of the stuff was discovered in the strong interactions where people had a pretty good idea what was going on. Eventually, QCD was going on. But they knew that at low energies, pions have special properties because they're Goldstone bosons. And so the fact that you can describe pions very quantitatively in the standard model is a similar argument, where in that case, you don't know how to do this integral because it's all strongly interacting. But you do know that what you've got has to be the most general thing, subject to some symmetries. And you do know how, in this energy expansion, every term that you write down in this Wilson action contributes to observables. So although you, in that case, you cannot calculate what all the coefficients are in the interactions of the Wilson action from first principles, you can parameterize them. And the nice thing is that once you've done that, because this is the most general answer you could get from something which is strongly interacting, what you have is predictive. It's something which, if it fails, it wasn't that some model was wrong. It means that the symmetries of your problem were wrong, and so then the standard model would be wrong. And the variation on that theme is if we are asking about physics that we haven't seen yet, so we really don't know what's going on, it's not that we just can't calculate it, same logic applies. You can organize, as long as whatever you haven't seen is heavy, you can organize the way to how it has to appear in the same kind of expansion and powers of 1 over the scale is of whatever it has. And one of the fascinating things about the standard model you probably saw in the Beyond the Standard Model course was, before I say that, I should say, another wonderful thing about this is that this explains why renormalizable theories have played an important role in physics. So quantum electrodynamics is renormalizable, quantum chromodynamics is renormalizable, the standard model is renormalizable. And in the old days, the renormalizability was a virtue in itself, because in practice it meant that they were predictive, that you didn't have a lot of infinite number of renormalizations to do. But this gives you actually a different take on it. It tells you that, I'm probably saying too many things before I actually get to the concrete. So the short version will be, if I expand the action in powers of 1 over some heavy scale, I will get couplings typically that go like one over the heavy scale. I'll get couplings like 5^15 divided by some mass to the 11th. And that mass will typically be the heavy mass, because I'm doing a Taylor expansion in 1 over the heavy mass, some light scale over the heavy mass, m light maybe, or lambda. And this is what we call non-renormalizable, right? Anything that has 1 over a mass in the coupling constant was a thing that made your theory not predictive. But the way we should think about that now is that that's something which is sensitive to physics that was at high energies, but it's only sensitive once we get to 11th order in the energy over m expansion. So in principle, if you want to know the exact answer, you need to know this and all possible powers of phi. But if you're only able to do measurements to one part in a million, and you know that the energy ratio is 10^-3, you can stop after you've worked to second order in 1 over m. And so that tells you that this kind of a term, although it's there and it's complicating things, it's really irrelevant to any calculation at a specific value of accuracy in E over m. And so it tells you how to organize non-renormalizable theories. They're really in secret. What's funny about them is that people, when they do non-renormalizable theories, have not, back in the day, in the 50s and 60s, they didn't articulate that they were in secret doing a low energy expansion, and that made them hard to interpret. But once you recognize there's a low energy expansion going on, they're no harder to interpret than a renormalizable theory is. But in particular, you understand why renormalizable theories are so important. Renormalizable theories were the ones where you never got any masses in a denominator. That's all the stuff that contributes to zeroth order in 1 over the heavy mass. So if it happened that you could understand some physics at some scale, and you could basically completely ignore the physics at the other scale because it's sufficiently small that you don't have to care, what will be left will be renormalizable, because you would have worked to zeroth order in 1 over m, and that defines renormalizable theories. So the reason that renormalizable theories are so important is that they're the ones that will dominate if you ever get a clean hierarchies of scales, and they're so separated that you don't actually have to even keep 1 power of 1 over m. So renormalizable theories are the things that you should expect to get at low energies. And so the reason I said you that was that if you take the standard model, which is the theory which seems to work with a couple exceptions, and ask, what was the big triumph of it? It was because it was renormalizable. But if you ask, now, what are the first things you could get that go beyond the standard model that are suppressed by some scale? It turns out there's one thing you can write down that's suppressed by 1 power of mass that's consistent with the symmetries and the particles of the standard model. And that one thing would give you neutrino masses. And so isn't it amazing that the one of the four things that the standard model gets wrong was neutrino masses? That kind of really smells like we're probably looking at a series like this. The dominant piece was the renormalizable part that seems to work really well, except for a couple things. One of those things was the first thing we could have written as a correction actually looks like it's there. It's the neutrino masses. So it really organizes all the ways that you think about physics are all very often aspects of this logic, that this is what's going on in nature. Yeah?
Is it possible that you have different high energy theories and they say they have somewhat the same?
Yeah,
so it's not really, yeah.
But that's why, if that was not possible, then it would be true that once we know what's going on at low energies, we know everything, right? We would know that it has to be this theory at high energies. Whereas,
it doesn't mean that we would have to know how to get there, right? This is a struggle to get there. But we know that if we get there, it has to be
right, and that's certainly not true, because the thing is that if all you knew was the Fermi theory of the weak interactions, there's a whole bunch of theories you can write down at the weak scale, which all give you the Fermi theory of the weak interaction. The real question is, how accurately did you know it was the Fermi theory of the weak interactions? If you knew it was infinitely accurately the Fermi theory, then that's actually very constraining. But in practice, you only know it's accurate to one part in something. And so that means that in this ratio of E over M, you're stopping at some point. And once you do that, there's a whole raft of things that could all be in the same low energy limit. And they're indistinguishable from what we would know.
So the fact that the standard model gets renormalizable doesn't mean that whatever is happening beyond the standard model is actually, there's a significant gap in the two scales. So
one way to read it is that the fact that the standard model is so successful means that it could very well be that we've seen all the particles that are at the energies we can reach, and the next ones will be very heavy, and which is kind of consistent with what people have seen at some level. That was that leads to, thank you for asking that, because that leads to naturalist questions. So you can ask, now, how far can I put off this physics? And the naturalist arguments are all about reasons why that physics that you're putting off can't be arbitrarily far off. And that's why people use it to organize what you would look for when you're looking beyond the standard model. But this does not say that there are, it could also be true there's light particles as long as they're weakly enough interacting. And one way they could be weakly interacting is that they could only be interacting through non-renormalizable interactions. And we know that that's possible because gravitons do that. Right? The beautiful thing about this is that you write down general relativity in the standard model, and the properties of the spin tube thing are such that it can't interact at a renormalizable way. So that means at low energies, it should be weakly interacting. And so gravity is weakly interacting, and that's a great thing. You'd like to know exactly why it's precisely as weakly interacting as it is. That's an open question, but the whole thing just smells good. And that's not always true in physics, right? So that's not to say that it's right. You know, I think that there's a lot of evidence that this is a good way to think about it. And it's not just in particle physics and condensed matter physics. You know, if you have not read it, you should go off and read this. There's an essay in the mid-90s by Joe Polchinski called Effective Theory of the Fermi Surface or something like that. And what he's doing is you know, if you're ever a non-condensed matter physicist taking a condensed matter physics course and you hear about superconductors, you think, wow, you know, what a crock that is. Because what they do is they throw away all the Coulomb interactions, which are probably big, and they keep this really, really feeble phonon interaction, and they track that non-perturbatively, and they find some little bound state, and then they claim that that's going to be a good approximation to what a solid does, and it works to like 10%. You think, that's amazing. How could that possibly have worked? And he essentially, in this article, he explains, I think, what condensed matter people already understood, but he explains it to the language that the rest of us can understand. And he shows that you can do the same logic that I'm doing here for low energies in the special kinematic case that you have a Fermi surface. So low energies, do not mean low momenta. So in that case, your momenta could be large, but you're on the Fermi surface and your energy is, compared to the Fermi surface, is small. And when you organize interactions that you could have had in the language of what would be there at low energies, what you see is that if you have things that have the quantum numbers of electrons, they don't have to be electrons, they could be dressed electrons or something, then all their interactions like to be non-renormalizable. So they like to be weak at low energies. And that's kind of, at some level, why the free electron model of metals works, you know, and also why free nucleons and nuclei works. Interactions are, the statement that people in the professionals would say is because of the Pauli blocking is making interactions weaker. You can kind of completely see in a low energy argument near the Fermi surface why interactions are generically suppressed at low energies. And there's a couple exceptions to that statement. If you have momenta that are equal and opposite, then it happens that those interactions are just marginal. And so you need to do a calculation to see whether or not they're going to grow or shrink at low energies. And those are the ones that give you they turns out for a superconductor, those interactions become strong, and then they give you the Cooper pairs. So there's a very, very beautiful picture where you apply this kind of language to condensed matter physics, and it works. And it also tells you how to organize what you think the corrections are. So it tells you why throwing away the Coulomb interaction, that wasn't actually a bad approximation. Those are all suppressed by energy when you go to low energies. So it's one of those, that particular paper is very well written. It's one of those epiphany papers. You read it and think, oh, that's what they're talking about. So it's not just in particle physics or in cosmology that this is important. I think it really organizes how you think about physics across the board. So there's lots of evidence that, because we've seen lots of hierarchies of scale in all areas of physics, in all areas of nature, and in all of them, this description seems to work well. So there's a lot of evidence that this is a good tool to be using. It doesn't mean that it's the tool that will be right at the end of the day, but it seems to work well. And if you take the examples of theories where people have tried to do things with quantum gravity, and here I'm thinking of string theory because it's the one that's worked out the most in detail, there again it seems to work. In most, I think there's a couple cases where people debate about it, but generically most of what you know about string theory you know about in this low energy limit sense. And so the evidence there is that the physics at high energies is also satisfying this decoupling property. So there's a lot of evidence from different directions that this is kind of a fruitful way to think about things. And I'm flogging that because in the end of the day, I'm going to take you towards a statement about how big the vacuum energy should be, and how unreasonable you think it is depends on how reasonable you think this formalism is. This effect of, there's nothing special but a classical action, it's just one more Wilson action at some other scale. And so I want you to understand that over decades, it's become the party line because it really is a compelling argument. And so what's interesting about the naturalist argument, which I may or may not get to today, for the cosmological constant, is that it seems to be jarring with this framework. And it's the one example that really seems to be jarring in a very concrete, hard to get around way. And so either way, there's something useful to be learned there. Either the one way in which you understand dark energy that's consistent with this, it's so hard to find that when you find it, that's the way nature works. Or this picture is a little bit wrong, and that's important to know because this is such an organizing way of thinking about physics in everywhere in nature that if it fails anywhere, it's really useful to know how it's failing. So it's that's kind of why I'm beating you over the head with this picture. All right, enough of the speeches. So in the tutorial, you're doing an example to try and make this concrete. And so it's just the simplest example where you have a complex scalar field. So the tutorial, you've got a complex scalar field. And then we'll take the Mexican hat potential, phi star phi minus v squared squared. And you know that this has a symmetry, phi goes to e to the I alpha phi. And so you know that there's, since we've chosen things so that this potential is minimized, that phi star phi equals V is the classical minimum. One thing you could ask is, why are we doing classical minima? And so first thing in the tutorial is to argue that if you scale lambdas out of phi appropriately, you can put a lambda out front of the whole action. And that shows you that lambda is appearing in the same place as one over h bar would if you look at e to the I action over h bar. So the series in lambda, it's actually, I guess, one over lambda because it's small lambda, small h bar. So that argument shows you why, for some regime in field space, the one that you use order one when you scale the lambdas out, it will be true that a lambda expansion is the classical expansion because it'll be the counting of h bar and the counting of lambda will be the same thing. And so it's in that part of field space that you should think of minimizing the classical minimum if you're looking for the vacuum, because the classical approximation is the leading approximation. And it turns out that the minimum you find, so phi of order v is in the right region where you trust the lambda counting is the classical counting. If you expand around that, you know that that choice, there's no way, you know, you have to choose, you can always choose your symmetry such that the, say, phi real is equal to v. Or and actually, there's some root twos running around in the tutorial that you'll see that I'm not writing now. But so no one can stop me from choosing. The way I'll satisfy this minimum is to satisfy it that way. If you choose something else, it's just a rotation compared to this one, a symmetry rotation, and that doesn't change anything because it's a symmetry. If I choose this minimum, then if I look at the expansion and I do this, the story that we've been talking about, where I expand phi is background plus fluctuation, and this will be zero background plus fluctuation, and I collect the terms that are quadratic, you'll see that this guy is massless and this guy is not massless. He's got some sort of a mass. And that's because we're looking at a Mexican hat potential. And if this is the real direction, then the phi r, you're measuring the curvature in that direction, which is not zero, whereas phi I, you're measuring the curvature in that direction, which is zero. And so the mass of this guy will turn out to be zero. And that's what you show in the problem. And so it has a hierarchy of scales. You could be looking at very low energies compared to this mass. You could ask, what's the low energy limit look like? And so in the tutorial, what you do is you calculate the scattering of phi I with itself and phi I with phi r. And you can imagine yourself being in a world where you've built the large phi collider and you're trying to figure out what this theory is. But all you have access to right now is the phi I's because you haven't got up to an energy where you can see the phi r's yet. And you're trying to figure out what's going on and you calculate the scattering rate. And you might have thought that the cross section will be some power of lambda, and that'll be a generic size for the cross section. And what you show in the tutorial is that that's actually not right, that the cross section is proportional to lambda, but it's also suppressed by powers of energy divided by mr. And you might have said, well, I see that at tree level, but if I did loop calculations, that maybe that changes, and maybe what'll happen is that two loops, I'll get something which goes like lambda squared with no energy suppression, and that'll be the dominant thing. So maybe that'll be what I have to do. And if you did that calculation, which you do not have to do for the tutorial, you'll see that it's also energy suppressed. And it turns out if you go arbitrarily down the lambda series, every term is energy suppressed. And so that's because this is a Goldstone boson. Phi I is trying to drop out of the potential because it's really shifting of phi I is related to a direction which is a symmetry direction. And so Goldstone's theorem says that its interactions should be suppressed at low energies. So that's kind of part two of what you show here. But then that's this thing where you now want to ask, well, what would it be the low energy? Since I'm interested in quantifying energy suppressions, that's the kind of thing that this formalism should be great at. And so can I describe the interactions of this low energy particle? And so what you do in the tutorial is show what the low energy Lagrangian is that captures these scattering rates.
So why does the Goldstone want to drop out?
So another thing you show in the tutorial is that the it's hard to see in terms of phi r and phi I, but it's easier to see if you use polar coordinates. So if you chose phi to be chi e to the I theta, if you like, then if I expand this around v, so if I write chi as v plus delta chi, and I expand this out, you can kind of see that the real part of phi is going to pick up. It's going to be basically chi. So to linear order, phi r is morally chi, and phi I will be morally theta. And so, but in writing it this way, you can kind of see that this symmetry, where alpha is a constant, corresponds to a symmetry where theta shifts by a constant. And that means if I run and write down a potential for chi and theta, it has to be true that it's invariant under shifts of theta, so it can't depend on theta. So that means the only way theta can appear in the Lagrangian is through derivatives, and that's why you're getting suppressions at low energy. And so it's because this thing is morally a symmetry direction that it's dropping out of the potential always. And that's a general thing for Colston bosons, that their interactions, and so a special case of that is the mass is zero because that's a special state, that's a subset of the statement that it's not in the potential.
So V could depend from derivative of
theta, but not the state. Yeah. So the most general thing will be if you, L of theta has to be something, arbitrary thing built at a derivative. So it's going to start off with, you know, d mu theta. And the dimensions are wrong, so I have to have a V squared. And we'll put a 2 there conventionally, and then we'll have the next thing you'd write down would be something like d mu theta squared, say, with some coefficient. And on dimensional grounds, that has to go like 1 over some scale, some mass to the 4th power. And so the part of what you do is you show, is that mr to the 4th, or is it v to the 4th, or how do the lambdas and the m's combine to give you the right answer? But the thing that you don't do in the tutorial, but which is amazing, is that you might have thought, because you're going to derive this for one process. You're going to look at scattering of the light fields. So for that kind of tree-level scattering, you're going to figure out this coefficient. But the amazing part of the story is not that. It's that once you've got this, you can calculate anything in this theory to order 1 over m to the 4th, and all you need is this interaction. You could calculate, if you made hydrogen out of this stuff, to order 1 over m, this is all you need. And so although you derive it for this one interaction, because you've got it in the Lagrangian, it's telling you how all observables depend on theta to that order. And so it's once you've got it from one calculation, you've got it for everything. So it's really a powerful, yeah.
Should that be dimensionless?
It should be dimensionless. So it's this has to be a mass to the 4th.
Yeah.
And this combination, I got it wrong, because I'm thinking that if I had scaled the v's in, let me write that as c. Yeah. Thank you for catching that. That's where the dimension counting was coming from. And so you can kind of see, you can move things around depending on how you define your fields, but it's a... So since the fat lady is about to sing here, so what I'd like to do is you're going to show this example this afternoon, and it's a very clean example. And it shows you how the thing that you're getting comes to you as a derivative expansion. And what I'd like to go to is two directions. One is I want to close back on the naturalist story for the vacuum energy. So how do we interpret the ability to renormalize divergences into the cosmological constant and decide whether or not we should be happy or unhappy about large values for vacuum energies? And the second thing is I'd like to do the power counting, because I'd like to take this theory like this and ask, if you gave me all possible powers of derivatives here, how do I know at some, you know, naively what you'd say is that this is the thing that appears at order 1 over m to the 4th, and that's simple enough when there's only one term. But if we go to the next order, you might have 7 terms that go like 1 over m to the 8th. And say we want to calculate things to subdominant order in 1 over m to the 4th, you'll have a question as to what do you do? Do you work to third order in this and then second order in the next one? And what exactly are the calculations you have to do? There's a very, very clean statement as to what graphs you have to calculate in order to work to any fixed order in 1 over m. And I'd like to give you that in this scalar example, because this is very much like gravity. This is like theory where you've got stuff which is derivatively coupled. And you'll see that when once we've done it for scalars, I'll repeat the argument for gravity, and it tells you something which you believe anyway. It tells you, if you made the same argument for how you decide what's the dominant contribution at low energies for scattering processes with gravitons, the dominant contribution will be essentially all tree graphs involving general relativity and nothing else. And that says that the classical approximation of gravity is the dominant thing. But then it also tells you what the corrections are to it. And it says the first corrections to the classical result are either one loop things with general relativity or classical calculations with some specific kinds of interactions. And so there's a very clean statement about this theory and in gravity as to what controls the 1 over m expansion. And where I'm going with that is that's what controls the classical approximation in these theories. It's the low energy limit is the thing that's controlling the low energy expansion is the classical expansion for these kinds of theories. So that was mostly talk, and next time we'll do something.